Welcome to Weird Games and Weirder People, a podcast about role-playing games and the weird, wonderful people behind them.
Hello, wonderful weirdos, this is Diogo Nogueira, and today's guest is the wonderful Justin Searoys. He is a novelist and game designer, as well as the founder of Severed Books, and now Severed Toys. But before I get to that, I have a few announcements. I am traveling actually this week, so it might be the only episode this week, because I'll be on Game On Expo from March 15th to 17th. I'll be doing panels, hanging out, so if you want to talk weird, look me up. I'll also be on next week on GaryCon on Lake Geneva from March 23rd to 25th. So I'll also be there, just hanging out. I won't be doing any panels or anything. So look me up, let's play something, talk weird, etc. But talking now about Justin Searoys, Severed Books publishes fiction, games, accessories, RPG modules. He has been doing this since 2012. He published a lot of stuff, and like, I want to be like him when I grow up. He does so much stuff. Collaborations include Stockholm Cartel, Aaron Drapling, The Dead Milkman, Andrew Irving, Head and Loppers. So many, many great people. And we talk about how he is the funny dad. We talk about his journey, writing, poetry, fiction, how we can explore the media of role-playing games. We talk about The Spine of the Night, this amazing animation, and how he is working with the creators of it to adapt and create things for role-playing games. We talk about Mork Borg, action figures for Mork Borg. He's working on Severed Toys, which is incredible. We talk about cooking, which is kind of his hobby. It was weird, it got personal, it was wonderful. So I hope you enjoy it as much as we did. So let's get weird with Justin Searoys. Hello, Justin. Welcome to Weird Games and Weirder People. How are you, my friend?
I am good and honored to be here.
Yeah, I'm honored to have you here. I think we've been, you know, talking and in touch in this RPG world for a long while, right? I think we were both kind of starting, you know, you had the Mimic Dungeon, it was Labyrinth, was it? Or no, was, what was the name of that one?
Oh gosh, like the very first Kickstarter that I did, the the Dungeon Dealer card deck. Gosh, that would have been like 2016, maybe. I think.
Yeah, I think, yeah. I met you a little bit after that. Was the dungeon that had, you know, everything was kind of this mimic kind of vibe. Was a thick hard book, mega dungeon.
Oh, Beneath.
Yeah, Beneath. That,
yes.
One.
Yeah. Yes, 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 yes. Yeah, yes. That, man, so I just adapted that from Mork Borg, and that took a long time to get through, yeah, that old thing. My gosh.
How was revisiting one of your early works and adapting to, you know, a game that's probably released, you know, kind of recently too, like it's kind of a, how was revisiting, did you keep it very faithful to the original, or did you saw the need to revise anything, or did you add anything new? How was it?
That's a good question. There was one table that really needed revision, and it was an important one. So that one got completely revised. But otherwise, I didn't touch too much. Like, my style is pretty minimal. So I feel like the GM and the players bring a lot to the table when they interpret the adventure. So I didn't feel like it needed that much revision. And then like, I've had subsequent adventures that tie into that Beneath book, that world. Mm-hmm. So I couldn't change it too much because it would alter the other adventures as well. So I didn't want to change it too much. It was really, it was fun to go back to it. Absolutely.
Yeah. And, you know, for the wonderful weirdos out there that maybe don't know who Justin Searoys is, can you tell us a little bit who you are, what is that you do, and, you know, share a small weird detail about yourself, maybe a habit or something, the way you choose things? I don't know.
Yeah. So I'm Justin Sarois. I own Severed Books and now Severed Toys, which will be launching soon. I have like 20 years experience in publishing. I owned a poetry like publishing press for like 10 years before Severed Books, doing like really esoteric avant-garde poetry stuff in both New York and DC and Baltimore. And then I got into fiction for a long time. I wrote like 7 novels, really in a very short period of time. I wrote just all the time, not all day, but as much as I could, writing just prose. And then when my first son was born, I just made the switch to creating games. Like I always wanted to be in that space. And I met the right people, the right mentors, and you know, just tried it out, and it seems to be working, question mark. in short, you know, 20 years of experience, I feel like I'm finally sort of like taking all that stuff that I've learned over the years, the drawing, the graphic design, the narrative prose writing, character development, tension building, and then my publication experience in manufacturing, finally like kind of getting to use every single one of those tools all together for the two businesses that I own. And I can't pretend to do any one of those things extremely well, but I think that together in a gestalt kind of way, I do bring something unique to the table because I have a lot of tricks that I can pull out and combine together to create something either novel or different or just something that never ever would be on the planet otherwise. So
yeah, it's something that you only you could do, right? Since you're like doing everything has such a mark of yourself that is anything else would be impossible to anyone else would be impossible to do those things, and that's great. And you mentioned switching to, you know, game design by the time your first son was born. And can you tell us how was that switch? Like what made you transition, you know, for fiction writing to game design?
Yeah.
Which is kind of your focus. So you still kind of do fiction sometimes, right? But your focus is the tabletop gaming right now, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. So two really huge things happened to me. So at the same time my son was born, I was also writing fiction. And then I had a series optioned for TV for like 4 years. And I learned a lot during that experience. But in the end, it was a very sort of sad and negative experience just because, like, you know, but obviously the property didn't get turned into a movie or a TV show. And I had dumped so much work into this thing, this project. Like the novels, the 3 novels are like 900 pages long, and that's just one task. And then I had to write, you know, a full season outline, a pilot, a show Bible, create a lookbook. And then for 4 years on spec without really getting paid, somebody took the script and sort of made their own thing and made a movie, which is pretty close to what my story is. So I remember like literally going to a bar and crying at the bar. Like I was that guy, head down crying at the bar because I had just seen the movie and it was like pretty darn close to what my world was. So that was one thing. So, and then the other thing, my son was born. I had been playing a lot of video games, like deep RPGs, Dark Souls, just thousands of hours in front of the screen. And I said to myself, like, I just can't do this anymore. I'm going to have a baby. So I need some other gaming outlet to satisfy that need. And tabletop came at the very, very, very crucial right time for me.
Wow. Yeah. And are you still able to enjoy video games nowadays. I mean, I kind of made that switch too, and I sometimes try to get back and enjoy a little bit, but I just get bored with it. Like, for I get a game and I play like for 1 week, and like, yeah, this is cool. And the second is like, yeah, it's okay. And the third is like, yeah, it's, I can't do this anymore.
It's really funny you say that, because like, there's so many games that I want to buy, like the new
Baldur's Gate 3. Have you played that? Like, I kind of want to, but I know, I don't know.
Dragon's Dogma 2 is about to come out, and I know if I buy it, just like what you said, if I buy it, I'll play it for literally a couple hours, I'll totally love it, but then never pick it up again, because I similarly get bored or inspired, and I'm like, wow, that just gave me an idea. I'm gonna go write a whole thing. So
and I don't know, and sometimes too, when I have to, if I have too much free time to play this for a long while, I think I should be writing something. I should be drawing. I should be, I don't know.
I think when your work starts selling, and you know, you have kids and a family, there's incentive there. It's very hard for someone of our age to sit down on a couch knowing they have these talents. And I'm not saying, oh, we're super talented, but you have a revenue source at your fingertips. It's very hard not to do that. And it's really fun. Like, it's just fun to sit down and dream of stuff, materialize it. And it feels so darn good when you're done, because you're like, wow, I have a book. Like, instead of wasting 30 hours in front of a computer, you have a book.
I think I feel worse by not doing it. It's like kind of exercise. Knowing it's not even about the money, because, you know, what pays the bills here is my day job. I don't worry enough to, you know, it helps. But I mean, it's more about, I can do this. I have all these ideas that I want to put forth. I keep imagining them, and I can physical for it. It's stuff that I want to make happen. Like, I want to materialize these things that I imagine, right? And if I have, because I don't have a lot of free time, like my day job, like we spend time with the kids, we have to do stuff at the house, you have to spend time with family and the wife and this kind of stuff. And the little free time we have, like, we have to divide by this stuff that you really want to watch or read, or a book or a movie or a TV series that you really want, you want to write to, and you know, and then there's too little to spare. I don't know.
Yeah.
With video games, I guess.
Yeah. I always joke that when, like, our retirement homes are going to be like lit, you know, like we'll be 80 years old with VR goggles on, and that's the time we'll get to play these like wicked, insane video games.
Yeah.
We'll be like 95 on some sort of weird hallucinogenic drug, having a blast. I'll just wait for that.
Although one of the adventures of, you know, this thing that we do, and, you know, I can imagine working until I die. I don't know, you know, because we have ideas, you know, we want some, I don't know, it's kind of a need. You have to put these things out in a way, right? Or they will start to clunk your head, you know, because you didn't put them out in a way.
It's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
Yeah. And, you know, Justin, did you mention anything like particularly weird about yourself? Maybe a habit or the way you dress yourself? Can you share just a small weird detail that maybe someone said for you? Oh, you know, Justin, that's kind of weird that you do that.
Oh, man. I'm sure there's 1,000 things that I do that are a little weird. Right now, it's like just trying to keep my 2-year-old alive. And, you know, all right, here's a good example. In order to keep my kids entertained, I'm always making like funny noises, you know, like fart noises, or like some sort of like bebop, skidoobop noise or whatever. And I was walking down the street, this is a few months ago, I was walking down the street, and it was kind of like in the evening, I had a beer, I was feeling really good. And I literally out of nowhere did that. And there was a stranger right by me. I was like, boop, 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 boop. Like, I literally like made a weird dad noise. And the stranger was right there. And they were like, oh. I think like having the willingness to always like embarrass yourself a little bit to make someone laugh. I mean, that's my quirk. Like, I'm always willing to just be a little goofy to make someone feel comfortable, even though that stranger definitely did not feel comfortable. Like, that's where my head was. I was like, I miss my kids. Actually, it was at Origins. I was out of town. That's what it was. That's what it was. And I was thinking of my kids, and that triggered it. Yeah. I was like, that's what made me make the weird dad noise. But the stranger was caught off guard.
Yeah, I love that. I'm kind of a goofy dad here too, and my kid loves me, thinks I'm super funny. But my wife don't enjoy it as much as I do. So I'm just gonna ask you, how does your partner appreciate, you know, your goofy humor and this kind of stuff?
Oh, she loves it, I think. she's goofy too. Like, we're always like making up songs, and like I think some of the best times we've had is just like driving in the car together, making up silly weird songs, and just screaming out the window, like really acting like teenagers. And so
that's great. And my son is learning from me, so it's driving my wife insane. No.
Nice.
The other day when we were like in the car and just talking, he's autistic too, so he gets into his hyperfocus and can stop talking. And then, you know, my wife was kind of stressed, so we asked him to slow down a little bit, and he asked, "Well, what do you want from me, mommy?" And she's got kind of, "Please, can we know a little bit of silence?" And he said, "Oh, so you want to talk about silence? Yeah, I can talk about silence. Silence is kind of..."
That's good material for a book. I mean, I would take that one. Aw.
Yeah. And just thing, we also, another thing we talk about here too a lot is about the weird. So we ask the guests here to try to define what is weird for them. And maybe how do they seek that in their work? Because your work has a lot of, you know, the unusual, the, you know, subverting some of the general assumptions. So what is weird for you, and how do you seek that in the work that you do and in your life in general?
Okay. Ever since college, a running theme in my work is really technology. So information technology, how technology changes us and we change it. And I think like even in Beneath, that first module adventure that I wrote, like the underlying theme is the internet invades a low fantasy setting. So it's almost a trick. Like, a lot of people read the beginning of that book and kind of give up, and they're like, "Oh, this is... what is this? This seems kind of normal," but it doesn't really set in until like page, it's kind of too late. It's maybe like page 80. And that was sort of maybe a mistake on my part. And to back up to answer your question, I did put an introduction into that book that says, "Oh, hey," like I really spelled it out because I made a mistake early on because, you know, writing fiction, it's all about this slow reveal and you can't really put your cards on the table. I didn't understand that at first when I was writing adventures. So I literally had to spell it out at first. Technology, absolutely. I remember in college, I worked at the bookstore. I went to art school, and on the first and second floor were the art supplies. You would go in and buy paint and canvases and printmaking materials. On the half of the second floor was a bookstore, a really well stocked like art bookstore with some poetry, great fiction, and lots of art books. And then on the third floor was the stock room. So you had the third and fourth floor. So you had to, like, as an employee, go all the way upstairs, grab a 30-pound bag of plaster and, you know, haul it down to the first floor for customers. But what I would do is I would take books from the bookstore and hide them in the stock room. And I would go up there pretending to stock stuff and just read for, you know, 20 minutes, 30 minutes at a time. And the Marsha McLuhan, Understanding Media, and The Medium is the Massage, those two books, when I was like 18, 19 years old, completely reinvented the way that I look at media in general, and it's informed my work ever since. Like everything that I touch, I feel like goes back to that guy and his approach to sort of like medium first, message second. I'm really infatuated with manufacturing and how things are produced, how
what's his name, the author name again?
Marshall McLuhan. I know no one else can see me but you on this, but here's an LP.
Mm-hmm.
The medium is the massage. So he was really active in the 60s and 70s as really like the first person to look at media, look at commercials in general, print commercials, TV commercials, radio commercials, and dissect them and kind of reverse engineer the way that we approach media from like the pre-literate societies up until now. And his overarching kind of thesis is that we create a medium, say it's like the printing press, that we control that press for a little while, but as it massages the culture, as it changes the culture, it's the printing press that's changing us. So every single medium that we create, for a little while we can just enjoy it as a medium, but pretty soon it's taking over. It's changing the way that we're interacting with each other. And that's only speeding up with the internet and AI and all that garbage. For me, like that shit is so interesting and weird, to answer your question, that it has always, always invaded my own brain and invaded my work. And I can't point to a single a single project that I've worked on where I have that sort of seeping in. Even like the most recent book, Sickest Witch. Yeah, it's like set in a forest and stuff, but there's strange modern references in there that I somehow can't stop doing. And I think it's fun and it makes it relatable, but it always kind of goes back to information technologies and how they kind of are controlling us, you know?
Yeah. Because they are, and it's kind of scary. There is this podcast that's it's called Tech Won't Save Us. It's all about how we are getting, you know, screwed by, you know, the big tech and stuff like this. And
yeah,
it's a great discussion. That like as technology advances, it should make our life, you know, easier and more comfortable, but it's always, you know, being used to exploit and generate more revenue for the few, and you know.
Yeah, absolutely. And like one of Marshall McLuhan's quotes, I don't remember it verbatim, is World War III will be an information war. Like he knew that in the 60s. He's like, it's not going to be a practical war. It's going to be an information war, whoever controls the information will win, basically. And he knew that.
It is kind of like this, right? Like the fake news stuff, the algorithm, and the thing that you said, like when something starts, we get to enjoy it as a medium. So I remember the beginning of even social media and the internet, that you would post something, people would see it. Like I had, you know, organic grew a RPG blog page to like 15,000 likes, and I would post something and thousands of people would interact with it. But now the same page, if I post something, it's like 50 people see it. Like we lost control of how we, you know, internet. We would go to internet to be easy to find. People could find you, could discover you. And you know, one of my creative crushes that I talk about here, like Bo Burnham, was discovered on YouTube. You know, and now he talks about how this would never happen with someone like him again.
Right. You know? Yeah. And we as like pedestrians or civilians barely understand how it's all functioning. Like we can read an article and they can explain it to us. But then tomorrow it just changes, and whatever algorithm they're using or Google or whoever, it's just, it's evolving so quickly that we can't keep up as individuals. So
like the seminars to use Facebook ads is like, try things out. That's the seminar.
Right.
Yeah, just try things out.
just throw money at it. Just throw money at it.
That's the tutorial. How do you use, you know, to reach your public? Just try a bunch and see what works. Great.
Yeah. And have fun. Well, you know, all the more reason to do what we do, right? So like, it just brings me more and more joy to sit down with a pen and a piece of paper and draw some guy in the forest and then scan it and put it in the darn book. I mean, that just like, at the end of the day, if I just get that done, I feel great, you know, and maybe seven people see it. That's
the stuff that I love too. And, you know, I tried to have publishers and, you know, do the more this kind of marketing and have to publish the stuff that you do, like you publish, you ship stuff, etc. And I can't. I'm the creation guy. If I have to deal with that, I can't. I don't have the executive functional capabilities for this kind of stuff. Do you think, you know, talking about weird and, you know, this information, all this stuff, but, you know, getting to RPGs now, and I always ask guests here is if they believe that role-playing games in themselves, like the medium, is it weird? And what is your favorite part of the role-playing game as a medium?
All right. Is it weird? It's weird in our like popular culture, but I think it's really, if you look back at history and like how people learned from each other before the telephone and the internet and all that stuff, like we lived in an oral society, right? Like people would sit around a campfire and tell stories, or you would like, really, if you respected your dad, your grandpa, or your grandma, you would sit down, you would listen to them tell a story, and that would become your reality. Or you would go to church. I don't go to church or any of that, but if you would go to church once a week, and you would pay attention for an hour to the sermon, and that would be, that became your reality for however long. That changes your brain. It becomes who you are. So role playing is really no different. I think that people role play all the time and don't really admit it. Super normal people, they go at least an hour.
You don't act the same way when we are in a game convention and then we are with your family dinner with your wife and kids. It's different.
Absolutely.
You know?
The
characters you play depends with the people we are playing. And you assume a character because you think that person assumes you are this thing. So you have to play it according to their assumptions of you too. So you're all kind of making models of each other, you know, to function in a way, right?
Yeah. So I don't think it's weird at all. I think it's cool that you role players can admit that, like, oh yeah, it's totally fine to assume this personality because you know what? Everyone else is doing it too. Like the guy who goes to the Land Rover dealership and leases a Land Rover is role playing that he's wealthy because maybe he can't afford it. There's so many versions of role playing that are happening every second, all the time.
We're just having fun with it.
We're just having fun. We're having a lot more fun than most people. What was the second part to the question? There was the weird part, and then there was the.
And what was your favorite part of the role playing game as an experience as a medium?
Man, so there's so many, but like, I think the community first, because you know I've been involved in like music communities, literature communities in different levels, you know, like academia, indie publishing with literature and fiction. I worked for the government for 18 years in that community, but when I think of a community who is mostly positive and mostly helpful and people who lift each other up, always like cross posting, you know, like, oh, hey, I just launched a Kickstarter. I need help. Like, I don't know anyone in this community that would blink an eye or even think for a second not to do it. Like, of course I'm going to help. Of course I'm going to like shout out your project or lend a hand with an illustration or something. So like that, and that probably goes back to like, you know, D&D turns 50 this year and Gary Gygax literally created D&D in his basement. So that never would have happened without his community of players and that collaboration. So that spirit, that like collaborative spirit is what I love most, hands down.
Yeah, that's great too. But I think that's also the way you focus on too in the community, but because you can see in both ways, right? Like the community is so big that it's not all good, right? We have bad stuff, and there's people that focus on that and say the community is terrible and it's toxic and stuff. And yeah, there is in every community, right?
Yes.
But I just say this kind of collaborativity and, you know, people helping each other, it is something that I don't see, like when I work at, as you said, when I, you know, I use it to work with children's book illustration and it doesn't work like this. And even in, you know, in the tabletop RPG community here in Brazil, one of the reasons I started writing more in English too is that the community is more helpful and more united and, you know, more amicable than I feel it is here in Brazil.
Interesting. You know? Interesting. Yeah, I can't put my finger on why that would be different here. It's just, for me, it's just been wonderful. Like, I remember really having no idea what the heck I was doing at first and just, you know, kind of throwing ideas out. And like, there were so many people that came to me and that they just kind of helped me out, like really did, like really early on. So,
You mentioned you had mentors. That was something I wanted to ask you. Could you talk a little bit about that? And then, you know, if you can tell who they were, what did you learn from them? And not only about, you know, doing the work, but how about, you know, be, you know, a good person in the community.
Yeah. So for fiction, it was Michael Kimball. Really soft-spoken, humble, minimal fiction writer. He helped me out and let me see a couple of things that I was doing wrong early on. And those skills folded over into the gaming world too. And then it was weird, like in that avant-garde fiction community, Ken Bowman, who did put out like Maze of the Blue Medusa through Seder Press. So he was an old friend of mine through the fiction community, and he came through town through Baltimore one day with his wife and stayed at my house, and he had just published that book. And I know with like Zach Smith and all that stuff, it's controversial. I don't want to talk about that dude, but he sat down and he ran it for us. I literally called everyone I knew, and my buddy Jimmy showed up and Zeb Cook, Planescape second edition showed up. And I still have his character sheet somewhere.
And the Eyes of Dread, right? And the X is Zeb Cook. Yeah. Wow.
So it was the three of us sitting in my basement, and Ken ran Maze of the Blue Medusa, and it was just so different and so weird. And Ken helped me out through a couple obstacles as too with the adventure writing. But yeah, those two guys. And then as far as influences go, I always point to Mike Mignola, like Hellboy, BPRD fame. He's always a point of reference for me, not as a mentor, but as someone who
kind of, you know, you study his work and he's kind of involuntary kind of mentor in a way, right?
I think so. Thinking about like the comic artists from the 90s, and a lot of them, you know, they did it a certain way. But I think Mignola, in the end, as far as like a creator-owned person, someone who owns their own property through and through, he's just done it right. It's been 30 years of that thing, and he's still creating that world, and it's still expanding, and it's wild.
Yeah, for sure. Justin, do you have any kind of creative ritual, something that you do to help you get into the mood, you know, help get the juices flowing before you start sitting down to write or draw or anything like this?
Yeah. So I think just through habit, because I worked for the government for so long, like for 18 years, I woke up at 5:15 a.m., jumped in the shower, brushed my teeth in the shower, didn't eat breakfast, got my coffee, and sped to work so I could get there at 6 o'clock.
What did you do for the girl? Can you tell us, or is it like top secret information?
Top secret,
what
man.
Okay.
Tip, no, I'm just kidding. I worked for 10 years. I worked in printing. So I would travel around the country to different printing plants to make sure there is like printing stuff correctly. So like big offset presses with like 10 different stations, big Heidelberg presses. And then for the last 8 years, I was in communications. So writing speech writing, writing journal entries, and writing for their blog. Just any kind of like writing you can think of. So yeah, but luckily I was on flex time, meaning that I could get there super early and leave super early. So a lot of times it was slow in the morning, so I would get writing done for myself at 6 o'clock at my desk, and once people kind of meandered in, I would, you know, work. But then I would go home right away and get home by 3 o'clock, put another pot of coffee on, and then I would write until like 5 or 6, like every single day. So I still do that. Like I woke up at 5 a.m. today, and you know, before my wife and kids are up, I had really like 2.5 very intense hours, you know, of writing. I did editing on a recent book, and then I drew a little bit. But I try to do that as often as I can.
And what time do you go to bed to wake up at 5 a.m.?
You know, if I lived by myself, I would go to bed at probably 9 or 9:30. But with the wife and kids, I end up probably going to bed around 10 o'clock.
Okay.
So I get a good like 6 or 7 hours.
Yeah.
That's usually
what I get too. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I always knew this, but I could never really articulate it very well. But a lot of people talk about time management, of course, but other people talk about time plus energy, you know, and I think that for me in the morning, before I've eaten anything, I grab that coffee. My brain is like at optimum, you know, optimum level. And I just know that like it's come through practice. It's come through experience. But if I can wake up every day and have those 2.5, 3 hours, then I can get 5 hours worth of stuff done. I just know I can. And it really, really matters, and it adds up. And like, that's something I used when I was writing fiction because it was so freaking demanding. You know, I had to write 2 to 3 pages a day, and that was difficult. But having 2 or 3 hours a day to do it, if you do it 5 times a week, you can write a novel in 6 or 7, 8 months. You just have to do it every day, like every single day.
Yeah, that's usually what I say, like 1 page a day. If you don't miss any day in the year, you have a novel.
Yep.
But in like 2.5 hours, you can write. If you manage to put words down, you can write quite a lot. Do you sit down to write again in the afternoon too? Or like you do all that you can in the morning and in the afternoon, you know, like you do other stuff, like house stuff, spend time with family. How is the rest of your day if you can put down that much work right in the morning?
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'll typically transition to drawing in the afternoon just because it's more meditative. It's just more fun. So like a lot of times I trick myself. So I do the hard stuff first in the day, or even if I'm cleaning the house, I'm like, I'm going to do the hardest thing first, and then everything's downhill. So
that's a good strategy. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm constantly like gaming myself to get things done. But it's a nice treat, you know, like I'll take a little, eat a little candy bar, grab my, my brush pen and knock out a couple weird liches. So, yeah.
Awesome. You know, we talk about some of your influence, people you learned from, but I always ask people here too about maybe sorts of inspirations beside exactly people, maybe an area of your life or, you know, media. I say that because I draw a lot from the stuff I consumed as a kid, was kind of my refuge, and like comics, cartoons, and movies. We also draw a lot from our daily lives, of course, as game designers and artists. We also, we are constantly watching out for inspiration, of course. But do you, can you sense anything, any area from which you're, you see yourself constantly drawing from in your work or in your art?
Yeah, so like definitely that, going back to that technology thing that I talked about, I mean, that's always present. But man, like, I'm kind of addicted to politics. Maybe it's living close to DC, like the capital, or and or working for government for so long. It's just the ever increasing weirdness. We'll go back to weird of American politics, like Trump and QAnon and all that. I mean, all that stuff is just.
Have you put QAnon on any game yet? Because that's kind of a weird cult, or
yeah, you know,
adapting that to fantasy would be, for a urban fantasy game, that's a great stuff. I'm gonna watch some of the commentaries to put some weird Q cult, a cult with Q, you know, right, cult with Q, and that's it.
Talk about role playing. I mean, like, if you're gonna get into any sort of like LARP, like QAnon is that's like the highest level LARP you can do, because they are
just
deep. I don't want to get in trouble, but so yeah, like I mean, part of my daily routine is, you know, going to like doom scrolling these like weird news sites, just seeing like, what did Trump say last night, like what kind of trouble is he in now, like and it's just, for me, it's just entertaining, and like a lot of that does,
yeah, I think comedians love him. Yeah.
Yeah. Because a lot of those.
It's a constant source of material, I guess.
Yes. So that weirdness kind of seeps into my work. It's just like, I guess I also like part of the fiction piece that I miss, because like the fiction that I wrote was deeply rooted in. Not history. Well, like the first two books that I wrote were about the Iraq War. And those were written around historic events like the battles of Fallujah, the bombing of Al-Mutanabi Street in 2007. So I'll admit, like, the one thing that I desperately miss is the realism and the tension of the work that I used to do. And I'm always trying to recapture that. So like, maybe in a way, the whole technology and politics thing is my way of grounding the work in reality and trying to
make things more meaningful, right? More, this is kind of serious. There is a message behind this. There is something I'm trying to say.
Absolutely. And I think that's really important to me. So, and that's where like I don't know if I don't want to say anything negative, but I'm not a big like, high fantasy person. Like I don't write about dragons. I don't write about fairies or magic. All my work is very low and as real
there's
as
nothing I wrong with that. Yeah, that's something personal. That's something you align to. I'm kind of the same way. Like this kind of high fantasy that everything is magic, kind of that became the norm from past 2000, I guess. Mm-hmm. Because of video games too. Like everything is shiny. Like you swing the sword and lights come out. And things like that, yeah.
Yeah, that never really interested me. So all of my work is almost always either low fantasy or as realistic as I can get. And even the sci-fi stuff that I've done for Mothership and Cyborg, it's pretty gritty. Like Aliens 2, people are still smoking cigarettes on the spaceship for some reason. You know, like that kind of thing. they still use like practical weapons, even though they probably have better stuff in the future. But yeah, it's that realism that I'm always craving to get back to.
Yeah, that's great. And are you currently working on any project you want to talk about and share us maybe your favorite weird parts of it?
Yeah, gosh. So right now I'm illustrating and designing graphic designing. I don't want to say I'm designing the game, but the two guys that did The Spine of Night, that did you end up watching it?
Yes, two times. It's so good. It's really good. It's kind of philosophical too. It's like this. Yeah. It's a weird psychedelic movie. It's a great animation with that retroscope style that you don't see a lot more. And you know, it's Sword and Sorcery. That's kind of primal feeling to it too. There's time travel. It's adventure, and there's a lot of philosophy behind too. I love it. I can't recommend it enough.
Yeah, I love it as well. So, excuse me. I guess I'll back up a tiny bit. I met Phil and Morgan, those two guys, through Brian Evanson. So the last project I did for Mork Borg was Brian Evanson's The Dark Glinting with Metal. And Phil from The Spine of Night blurbed that book, that project for us. So I was emailing with them. I was like, oh, shoot, man. Like, I love your movie. Like, wow. would you ever want to do a game project? And he immediately was like, probably yes. Let me talk to my partner. So Morgan and Phil got back to me like 2 weeks later. We started talking, and they have already delivered their manuscript for Veilgrave. And I'm illustrating that right now, and I'm hoping that'll be on Kickstarter in June or July. That is super exciting.
What is Veilgrave?
Gosh, I don't want to say too much about it yet. It is, oh man. So people, of course, it's a dark setting, but people are being either kidnapped or voluntarily turned into oil. They're being like turned into like a vaporous drug that you can inhale, and it allows you to travel into different dimensions. But you're basically like you're huffing people. So that's all I want to say. I mean, it's absolutely psychedelic, like just like The Spine of Night. It has like some of the same themes. And you can skeletonize yourself through the game. Like in order to go through the veil, you can opt to turn yourself into a skeleton, just strip all your flesh away, and you can kind of live. That's an interesting mechanic. But
you live as like a skeleton.
Yeah. Wow. So yeah, working on that's been awesome. But before we launch that on Kickstarter, we're gonna do the first party Mork Borg action figure. Sort of a bucket list thing that I've always wanted to do, and I feel like, you know, talking again about manufacturing and having all this experience kind of like boiling into one business, I know that we can do it. Like, I have the right factory, I have the right the rep between me and the factory. Like, we have a good understanding. So it's super exciting. Johan and Pella, like, they seem pretty jazzed.
Yeah, that's amazing. I would love to have, you know, action figures for Primal Quest, like fantasy, Stone Age guys and dinosaurs. That would be amazing. I'm sure they are excited.
Like,
Mork Borg is becoming like a giant, right? And everything has kind of this Morky multiverse, right? Like the...
Yeah.
Mork Borg cinematic universe, kind of a way.
I mean, like, to talk about community, like the people, the third party creators that are helping boost Mork Borg, they're all interesting and weird and fun, and like, it's very rare that I pick
great
up
stuff.
It's rare that I pick up a a book, and I'm not impressed with the quality of like what the third party people are doing. So as far as like, I will say like creating an action figure sucks in a few ways. I mean, it is just so expensive. Yeah. It's hard. Like, we got lucky because we found a great sculptor through my buddy Nick Patara. I can talk about him later, but his axe wielder will be the next action figure. But yeah, we found a great sculptor that can capture the sort of tone and mood of the art in three dimension, and that's super freaking difficult. And this guy's very gifted and fun to work with. But then also, like, there's a lot of hurdles. There's the money part, because in order to do just a basic 7-inch action figure, that's like $35,000 just in the tooling, the molds, like the injection.
Yeah, that's most of the cost, I think, right?
Yeah, that's before you put plastic in there. So
you pay all that and you don't have one to use.
Right. Just stare at the molds all day. Yeah. But I feel like with Mork Borg and the community behind it, I think it's like the perfect test case for us to attempt to do it. And if it funds, it funds. If it doesn't, I will be very sad. But yeah. I feel like we can do it right. We can't rush it. It has to be like super high quality. Pending how many subscribers we get, signups, we should be launching sometime in April.
But, awesome.
Yeah. People can sign up now. People can go there. Go to.
Yeah. You put the links there. If please say the link, and we'll put it on the show notes too, for sure.
Yeah, if you just go to severedbooks.com, there's the crowdfunding page, and it's all linked up there. Or you could go to severedtoys.com. That's maybe the easiest way. But yeah, for the just to like, this is the part where I really sell it. For the first 48 hours, the backers all get a special flanged mace. So like a big ass mace that'll come with the figure. I think it's cool. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think I shared it on Facebook recently.
Yeah, I would love to back it, but from Brazil, I can't, like the taxes would not gouge us. But it looks cool, like the spine rack, like for zines you made, looks fantastic, and you're making great stuff, and I'm excited for this, and excited, hoping this really succeeds to see what other game will have action figures in the future. So I'm excited to see where that goes.
We'll see.
Hello, wonderful weirdos, this is Diogo Nogueira again, and today I'd like to talk to you about one of my favorite games, a game that I created, and you know if you listen to the podcast, I love dinosaurs, and it's called Primal Quest. It is a weird stone and sorcery adventure game. It's a NSR game, which is this game that caters to the old school style of play, but has more modern and more cinematic gameplay adapted to our modern sensibilities. It has adventures with dinosaurs, ancient civilizations, spirity, sorcery, aliens, elder gods, and much, much more. It's very pulpy. It has, you know, a complete rule set, a mini hex crawl, an adventure introductory adventure. You can find it at Exalted Funeral, itch.io, Drive-Thru RPG, and your best local game store. And we're releasing more and more stuff for it, so stay tuned and play Primal Quest. So let's get back to the weird with our chat. What would you say, Justin, is the weirdest game you played, or a really weird game you played recently that left you an impression? And it can be tabletop or video games. I know, like me, you don't play much of those, but you know, any kind of game, board game, and or just playing with friends or anything like a LARP or anything.
Man, all right. It wasn't recently, but my buddy Adam Good ran 10 Candles for us a couple years ago, and it was so profoundly personal and just screwed up that we still talk about it. I still reference it. I still like sort of am a little jealous of it. You know when you play a game and you have that little bit of jealousy, you're like, oh wow, like
why didn't come up with that, right? Yeah.
Yeah, or like that's memorable. Like I'll never forget that. Damn, you know? Really, and like I was my character was this female experiment. She was a musician in residence at a facility. I can't remember what kind of a, it was like a very commercial facility. She had no reason to be there, but she had some sort of weird residency where she was making music with the tools there. But she was wheelchair bound. So I had to wheelchair myself through the game. And I was one of the last to die. And I ended up at my childhood home crawling up the stairs from my bedroom, basement bedroom and I died in the driveway, like looking up at the sky. And everyone was just like, holy crap. Like, damn. it was just profound. But like really beautiful. Oh man, it was messed up.
Yeah, that game was you know mentioned before here. I haven't played it, but I'm you know really looking to see an opportunity because it sounds really impactful and different, and you know leads to impactful gameplays like this. It's really good game design.
Yeah. And pretty minimal. Like it gives a lot to the game master to craft like where it's going. But when done well, I've had multiple people tell me like, wow, like that's one of the best games I've ever played. Like a session of 10 candles.
Wow.
And also like the tension for me, like a lot of it is tension, not just building, but maintaining and shifting. And I feel like just the mechanic of blowing out the candles and environmentally as it gets darker and darker, it's hard not to be totally bought in. Like you're just in it and it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
It is such a simple but effective mechanic.
Yeah, because it kind of plays with this reality of the game and the reality you are as a player too. As you said, like the median is the message and they're playing with the median of you know, like you're not only in the story in the station, in reality too as a player, it's getting darker, it's getting kind of strange and more clustered, you know. So yeah. That ties up with what you're talking about earlier. Justin, do you have any other hobbies, you know, besides, you know, role-playing game now, it's not kind of only a hobby, it's kind of a job too, but do you have anything else that's just for you and for you to enjoy and create and play with?
Gosh, it's hard because like my kids are really young and I feel like every second of my day is either feeding them or running around. But cooking, like I've tried to get more into cooking lately. Like there's this amazing market up the road and I go there sometimes and get like giant hunks of meat and try to like do different things with those, like in the slow cooker. So that's something like I love and I can share with my family. Nice. But I've also gotten back into comic books, which is really fun and nice. And that was like
writing, drawing, or making a project or something for
oh no,
just practicing,
just reading. Like I had stopped reading comics for a long time, and then when COVID hit, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'm working from home and I have all this extra money because I'm not eating out. And so I just started reading a bunch of different things. And that was, for me, it was really healthy because I hadn't like really dove into modern comics in a long time. So that's how I met. Like,
you can recommend anything?
Right. I mean, I hadn't read Something is Killing the Children. So I'm going through that right now. Ultra Mega? Have you read Ultra Mega?
No, I don't know what it is.
Oh man, it's by James Herron. Do I have it over there? I'm just going to show you the cover. I know this is a podcast, so it doesn't really matter what I hold up to the camera.
But we can describe it, yeah.
Yes, I will describe it. So I'm not into like kaijus or giant robots or anything like that, and I was very skeptical to get into this book. But the artist worked on BPRD, like Hellboy, for a while. and I had collected his art for a little bit. So I was like, shoot, James Herron has, he's not only drawing it, he wrote it too. Like, it's his own thing. So I had to pick it up. And just imagine Ultraman, but with horrific body horror happening. Mm-hmm. And some really unexpected emotional twists in the story. It's fabulous. Ooh. I can't recommend it enough. Ultra mega.
Yeah, I will look it up and I'll put the link in the show notes, people, to check it out too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you
have, by any chance, maybe like a dream project you always wanted to work on and then, you know, you're still getting into that?
Yes. So I'd be really a little scared to work with Mike Mignola, but if I could create any sort of anything with him.
Scared? Why? Why scared?
Well, you know, like collaborating with a hero. So like, what if something went wrong? Kind of thing. You know, like I wouldn't want to upset or disappoint someone that I admire so much. But
do you think you would? Why do you go there? Like, you straight mention the fear.
Oh gosh. Well, like I don't know why I mentioned that right away, because I feel pretty confident in what I can do and what I can make. There's always just between like manufacturing hiccups, and I'm always pushing the envelope and trying something new. So like, maybe if I did collaborate with him, I would just do something I know how to do. But like, seriously, like I feel like with every project I've done recently, I've been adding a little bit more, and not that it's been biting me in the butt, but I'm just sort of risking a little bit each time. I mean, especially with the spinner racks, like the spinner racks.
Yeah. I've noticed that you're always trying to do things a little bit different, you know, something a little more strange, a little bit more unusual, and that's very cool, and I'm very happy it has been going your way. And do you see any reason why you're always, you know, trying to push a little bit? Do you feel the need to try something different, or you're just...
I think there's a number of reasons. One, it's fun and interesting. Two, it keeps me different and relevant, I hope, in the marketplace. And three, you can make a little bit more money. Like, I don't want to sound shallow or callous, but you know, you can put out an A5 book that's 80 or 90 pages, and there's that item. But then you can also bundle it with, like, I'm doing those Meeple small party guys, those sets of six like figures. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if I do a book and a set of those six little figures and maybe one other small thing, you've turned a project that makes X amount, and you might have times it times three or four just by adding on some interesting stuff with it. Mm-hmm. And the extra stuff I really love. Like, that's stuff that I think is fun and cool looking, and I use in games. And like, I'm never going to make something that's just like silly, or like, well, some stuff is silly, but, you know, something
is
super
fun too.
Yeah. But like, I'm always, hopefully anything that I make or add on to a project isn't superficial and always adds another level or layer to it. And people just love it. Like, that's really the end goal, is to have fun and have people love my stuff so I can sustain my lifestyle and keep having fun and blah blah blah. I think a major thing that makes Severed Books and Severed Toys different is my ability to create new and interesting modest items for tabletop gaming.
And I think you've done well, and I think all those extra things really add to the playability of the thing, or make things a little bit more whimsical, I guess, in a way too, and I think that's important to games, especially games with horror and stuff. It adds a little bit of levity to make things more bearable in a way.
Yeah.
You mentioned about, you know, hobbies and, you know, having kids and young kids. You have a 2-year-old and you have more, another kid too?
Yeah, Ivor is 7.5. God, he'll be 8 in April, so we'll just call him 8. And then Gray, the little guy, he's 2.5.
Wow. Yeah. And how is your kind of how are you as a parent? Like, what do you usually do with the kids? And in how does that affect the way you do your work too? And how do you divide those things? Because I'm always with the sensation that, you know, more time with the kids too, but I have to do the work. And how do you divide those, balance the parenthood?
It's not easy. But like, so my wife hadn't worked for 7 or 8 years, and she just recently went back to work full time. So she's right now, she's on a business trip. So when my kid gets off school and the younger one gets back from his grandparents, it'll just be them and me for a day or two. And like, this kind of goes back to me waking up at 5 o'clock. Like, if I didn't wake up at 5 o'clock morning, if I'd kind of puttered around and woke up with the kids and whatever, I would have gotten zero done today. Like, it just sort of, the momentum of the day would have just sort of melted, and I would have maybe watched Fargo, you know, like something, you know? So yeah, like the balance is tough, but hopefully when the kids get home, put my phone away. I'm not great at like putting the phone away. I'm always distracted. So I have to like literally maroon my phone.
Yeah, me too. It's a learning process, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's hard, especially when you're creating stuff and like trying to promote something, and time really matters. Urgency matters. So, I try to get them as outside as much as possible. We're very lucky. We live in Maryland, where really just a mile or two away, there's like a park with a creek and like chickens and like tons of wildlife. Yeah. And then, on the flip side, my older kid loves retro video games, and I bought one of those clone systems. It's called, Super Console X or something. And it has 190,000, you know, 16-bit, 18-bit games, Neo Geo. It's got Capcom stuff that was only released in like the EU for some reason. And we've been jamming it on that a lot. So it's really fun to like, you know, watch him light up. We'll play like a side scroller co-op, like Golden Axe, for just half an hour. That's, you know, like, yeah. And he is just like in heaven, you know.
So that's awesome.
I like introducing him to the older stuff, because I used to talk about this a lot. Like, those older games give your brain space to think and imagine, because there's so little to look at. So like, I remember playing like the first Final Fantasy, and a lot of that game is so slow. You're just kind of traversing the landscape, or you're going from here to there. And as a kid, I remember just thinking, making up a story in my head, like the relationships between the characters, like, oh, I'm this guy and I have a crush on her and I'm going to talk to her when we get to the village. Wasn't always about that. But I love introducing Ivor to those older games, because it does allow you to kind of insert your own narrative into the experience, you know, where like modern games today, you get everything. You get like with Baldur's Gate 3, you get more than you want, probably. nothing OSR true. About it.
You know, talking about kids, and it's something that I see a lot in my kid. I see a lot of myself in them, like the weird stuff that he does. And I'm like, yeah, that's weird. But I used to do that same weird stuff. Do you have anything like this? Like, do you notice the weird particularities of your kids? And say, yeah, I used to do the exact same thing.
Yeah, so I was never diagnosed with anything, because my parents... My parents, like, either they didn't know or care, or they were just sort of like,
whatever. Yeah, that generation, they didn't have time for mental health too, right? You know, at least my parents were always working or doing something, and, you know, I was spent a lot of time with my grandma, and people didn't talk about this stuff back then. So
yeah. They really, no, they didn't. You're right about that. But I was, for a long time, I was obsessed with symmetry and even numbers. Like everything had to be, like all my toys had to be symmetrical. I remember I had this one cool, like lobster looking action figure. And the only thing that wasn't symmetrical was there was a red square or something on his lapel. And I had my dad literally take nail polish and paint on the other side the same thing. I would like go like this with my fingers, like 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, back and forth. And I would do it in my mouth on my teeth. Like I would touch the tip of my tongue to my teeth all the way back and forth and back and forth. And I felt like if I didn't do it, something terrible would happen. Like, so I'd get, I would get spun into these weird rituals, even like touching things twice. Like I called it clearing it, where like if I touched the refrigerator door, I would touch it once and then touch it again to like, as if I was getting away from it. Either way, I somehow got over that myself without any help from my parents, whatever. And I guess it just went away over time. But I see my older son has very similar stuff going on, like very, very similar. He doesn't like to touch metal a lot of times when we're eating. So it like really freaks him out, like a metal spoon, anything metal. If my wife is wearing a necklace that's metal, he won't eat. Like it grosses him out. So
yeah.
You know, we're all weird, and like
yeah,
it's either we channel it and turn it into good, or it goes away, or
and it's kind of understanding that we are all going through that. It's not like my kid is doing that to be a jerk to me. No, it's we all have this kind of stuff and doing our best like to deal with that, and I see some of the stuff, you know, makes our life difficult, and we sometimes get, you know, oh, why are you doing that? But it's, and I see my son really trying to deal with this kind of difficulty, and it's helpful to remind myself that, you know, I had to deal with a lot of that stuff too, and
yeah,
be patient, right, and be there
point.
To help.
As a young person, those small things can be huge, you know.
Like, yeah. Oh yeah.
I can't remember a great example, but I just remember feeling so overwhelmed and helpless at certain points.
Mm-hmm.
And you're right. To like, my wife always says, you know, just pause. Don't react. If our kids are irritating us or doing something that we think is totally off the wall, just
they're
pause.
Going through a tough time. It's not us. Yeah, it's them that are going through a
take a breath. Because I grew up the opposite. You know, my parents were very reactive and...
Yeah, me too.
Mostly my extended family. I mean, they were just brutal. They were just brutal people. Like, they made fun of each other. It was just always at someone else's expense. And I feel like it's hard to deprogram yourself from that.
It is.
You know, like, it's very difficult. So
it's a low... process, but it's doable. Yeah. But it's a lot of work, right? Yeah,
it is. Yeah, I mean, you're a product of your parents. I mean, you become them if you're not careful.
If you're not careful, yeah, exactly. But it's also so rewarding when you see that the choices you're making are having a good impact on your kid, and you see they doing the right thing and being lovingly and being, you know, empathic, you know, and helping. And
it's great. My wife, God bless my wife, she is very good at, even if we mess up, she will go back and explain as best as we can to the kid why we reacted the way that we did.
Oh yeah,
that's
very important to say you're sorry. Like we will screw up, we're not perfect, we're parents. We have to be better than our kids in controlling this, but we will fail, right? It's inevitable. But you know, just go back and talk to them and say we're sorry, like my parents never said that, and you know, and
same. You know, a lot of those skills, not to bring it back to like role playing, but like I feel like a lot of the parenting skills maybe could make you a better GM in the end, because it makes you more empathetic.
Welcoming,
even a better listener.
Yes.
Yeah.
That's true. Never thought about that, but yeah, it has some parallels, you know, parenthood and GMing and, you know,
yeah,
GMinghood, or I don't know. Yeah.
your players are like your kids in a way. They're all listening to you. They're trying to get the next clue to what life is going to bring.
That's true. You know, talking about more weird experiences, you know, I know kids can be weird enough and, you know, kind of change their lives, but have you ever had other, you know, weird experience that's kind of made you think different, maybe near-death experiences or maybe out-of-body experiences that made you see things in a different way or anything like this?
I wish. I am so just sort of like pragmatic, and I mean, maybe that'll change as I get older and think more spiritually. And I feel like when I was younger, I thought more about spiritualism, but man, I am, in the end, I am just a caveman, like scratching out some books.
Yeah.
I mean, living in Baltimore, I've had, you might be able to speak to this too, because we've talked about this a tiny bit, but I've been held up at gunpoint twice. I've been jumped. This is all in the street. I've been jumped once, and like parts of Baltimore can get a little frisky at night. And like as a younger person, well, even like me and my wife got held up at gunpoint when she was pregnant. And that's sort of life changing. I think about those instances, and I mean, they always sort of make you reevaluate what you're up to and how you're operating day by day. So I feel like I'm very grateful for where I am right now. Like, no, going through what I've been through and the near death experiences that I've had, I feel so darn lucky that, knock on wood, I'm healthy. I haven't been shot. I'm not in jail. I wake up every day and do things that make me happy. So, you know, I don't believe in ghosts. I've never seen an alien, but I do wake up with a sense of gratitude that I hope I can share with other people. I hope it's infectious.
Yeah. I mean, while I was in Gincon and hang out with you, you always had like a good vibe. You always made me feel welcome, and I had a great time hanging out with you, and it feels great. So I think that works in a way. So thank you for that. You know,
thanks.
Talking about, you know, the violence and you know, being held at gunpoint, living here in Rio de Janeiro, which is pretty violent, and talking about parenthood too, I remember one day we, you know, had my kid wake up in like 3 a.m., you know, feeling really bad, and we had to take him to the emergency room, and we go to the car, and here you have to make a choice, like, do we put the kid in the car seat because it's safer, or we don't, because we first stop at gunpoint at the street. Sometimes they don't give you time to take your kid out of the car seat. So how do you ask a parent to make the decision? Do I risk my baby's life by an accident or by being kidnapped? It's ridiculous,
that's,
you know.
That's as heavy as it gets, man. That's really heavy. I've thought about the same exact thing living here, and that's a parent's worst nightmare. Like, yeah. It literally makes my stomach hurt. Yeah.
No, talking, you know, maybe a more light subject. Have you ever, you know, tried meditation or other hypnosis or anything that, you know, alter your sense of reality and perception, or even if not that, have you ever, you know, tried psychedelics or anything that made you alter your perceptions, and did the experience impact you in any way?
I've definitely, like, I don't know how much I want to admit. I've experimented with stuff. But I feel like, man, I'm just like, I'm still, I am still so pragmatic when it comes to just like, we're mud people on this mud ball. And, you know, any second some asteroid could just split the planet in half and no one would ever, it wouldn't matter. Like, just because we're bugs, you know? I just feel like we're bugs. I guess two answers. For meditation, I walk a lot, and that's super helpful. So if I'm having a bad creative day, if my brain isn't working, if I'm too hungover or whatever, a long walk always helps. And that's, my body has to be active in order for me to relax. Like, I can't just sit. Like, that's never been something I can do. Like, I hate the beach. Like, I can't sit on the beach and just relax. I always have to walk around or drive a car. Like, I can relax if I'm driving, basically. So I need some sort of distraction. So that helps a lot.
But do you do anything while, like, walking? I do kind of a meditation walking too, and, you know, trying to just soak in the senses and forget about the stuff I'm thinking about. Because if I just go for a walk and continue to think about the stuff that's in my mind, doesn't do me any good. So I have to actively make the effort to, you know, hear the sounds that's, you know, playing the streets, you know, look without judgment and trying to smell and, you know, kind of activate my senses one by one to get out of my head. Do you do anything like this when you go for these meditative walks?
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. It's just being present, I think, and no screen, no internet, just allow yourself to sort of dream, like a waking dream. I remember when I was working on that, the longest series of fiction that I completed, in order to brainstorm, I would literally walk, I would drive to the mall. We have this mall that was by my old house, and it's constructed in a loop. So you can just do circuits around the mall. So like, people probably thought I was crazy because I would walk around the mall and sort of like talk to myself a bit. Then I would sit down on a bench and write something down. Then I'd keep going around talking to myself, you know, talking in characters' voices, trying to work out a scene, like literally like working out scenes in public. Mm-hmm. So sometimes it's meditative. I guess it depends on what I'm working on. Sometimes it's just meditative. And then sometimes it's very active where I'm like, in a way, like role playing as I'm walking around.
Kind of helps think too. Yeah, kind of helps you think too. So you can walk to empty your head, but you also can walk to maybe filling it in with good ideas and put it on the paper too, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, there's something about, like, I don't know if it's blood flow or just making your muscles move. But for me, like, I'm surprised I haven't gotten up yet. Like, I'm still sitting on the stool. It's an hour and 20 minutes.
An hour and 20, yeah. I'm sorry about up. That, yeah.
I'm just going to stand up with some stretches.
Yeah, great.
But, I feel way more lubricated, I guess, in my brain if my body is also the same way.
I think everybody does, but we forget sometimes and we get comfortable and it's hard to move around if you stay motionless for too long. You mentioned about all this skepticism and, you know, being mud people in a mud ball, but you also, you know, talked about the examples you had and what you learned, how to, you know, be good, and then the values of community. So even though you might not have, you know, a religion or maybe spirituality, you do kind of have something, morals or kind of a philosophy that helps you, guide you through life. And do you have anything like this that you can maybe talk a little about us and how maybe does that help you to deal with tough situations, and also where did you learn that from?
That's such a good question. So my creativity, my writing and my drawing and whatever I'm making, I mean, that is my therapy and that is my mantra and religion.
It is.
Absolutely. Like without it, I mean, I've admitted this to a number of people. I think without writing and drawing, I would either be in jail or dead. Like, because my anxiety would have taken over. My bad habits would have taken over. I wouldn't be waking up early to create stuff. I'd be sleeping in late and probably going to the bar, and I wouldn't have lasted through my 30s. You know, like I would have remained a bartender. I mean, I was a bartender in my 20s, early 20s, and a club promoter. If I didn't have poetry back then and stuff, I would have been a mess, like a total mess. So there's that part. But I can't remember. There was like I don't know if there was a second part to your
Yeah, about the philosophy. Where did you learn how to be?
Oh, right.
Because you talked about parenthood, and you also talked about how our parents weren't so great as parents. And then, where did you learn to say no? I won't be like this. I want to be better. I want to, you know, be more centered. I want to, I don't know, be more present. You know, this kind of mindfulness stuff. Where did you learn this from? How did you learn to value, you know, community? Like, this is the favorite part of the hobby for you. Where those values come from? I would try to.
I have no clue, man. Because like I remember when I was really young.
It could be one of the books you read. Like maybe you read some kind of philosophy or things with morals that left you an impression, or no? You can't remember anything specific.
I think like thinking back to when I was a teenager, I always felt like being yourself was the most important thing. And I think, all right, I do want to credit my parents for that. So like my mom and my dad, they're really strange people. They don't follow any rules. They're not normal. And they're normal, but they're not. They're like kind of like secret eccentric people that keep it quiet, but deep down they are so freaking weird, man. And like, I tell this to my kid a lot. This is the best thing I have for him, is the best gift that you can give someone else is letting them be themselves. Like letting that person be themselves. Don't be judgmental. Don't bring your own baggage. Let them laugh. You make an effort to smile, they'll smile. Just let them be themselves. That's it. And if you do that, then we're all going to win. And I think, like, even though my parents never, ever told me that, I think they told me that in the way that they were.
That's cool. And did they let you be yourself?
I'm getting a little emotional. Say what?
Did they let you be yourself? Like, you talked about how them were really,
yes,
they are really themselves. Did they let you be yourself?
They did. They, like, my That's parents great. Were the first, when I wanted to paint, they just got in the car right away and bought the paint and the canvases. When I wanted to listen to death metal, they ran me down to the store and got me the death metal. Like they never, ever, ever said no to a creative thing. And that has made so much difference in my life.
That's awesome.
And I don't think I've ever really said it like that before. You know, I've thought about it, but I've never really admitted it. And, I've been resentful towards my parents because there's two ways to go. Like, you can be not caring and just let your kid do whatever they want, which is kind of what they did. Or you can be a helicopter parent and be overbearing, and then your kids hate you. I've always been a little resentful that they weren't more hands-on and pushed me to do certain things. Can't have it both ways. Obviously, I feel lucky that I had it my way, 'cause I turned out fine, I guess. But I guess to answer your question, it was that upbringing, being able to just sort of experiment, go in my bedroom, draw some silly stuff, bring it up to my parents, and they look at it and give me a thumbs up, and I go back down and do it again and again and again. And that was really huge. And I feel like I've always stuck with that. Like, I've always wanted to be different, be myself, but not too much, not in an obnoxious way. But yeah,
not being different for being different, just being yourself, right? Yeah,
absolutely. Just be yourself, and like, yeah. I hope I can pass it on to my kids. That's if I pass on one thing to my kids, that's it. Like, let people be themselves, and then you be yourself, and make yourself happy. Learn how to make yourself happy through art, through writing, through basketball, whatever the heck you love. Just do it well and be kind.
Yeah, that phrase you said, like, the best gift you can give someone else is to let them be themselves. It's beautiful. And I don't know if you know who the author of that is, but it's...
Yeah, that's me, baby. Be...
Oh, yeah.
I'm taking credit for that. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm putting here, okay? No, just seeing we're getting like into the end of the interview, and now I ask you more whimsical and, you know, fun questions to get to know more about your personality and tastes. So if you could dream about, choose the things you dream about when you go to sleep, what did you dream about?
Man, gosh, that's a great question. I feel like I'm living my life so well right now. Not that I've like, oh, I've peaked and like my life can't get any better. But, you know, I wake up and I create stuff, and my wife is lovely and supportive, and my kids are great. And when I go to bed, I literally just sort of fall asleep right away. But I do have dreams. I obviously have dreams. And I just want to like get better at what I'm doing, collaborate more with people I love. I feel like just getting better and better at running this little weird business and making highly crafted books. Is that weird? I mean, that's what a weird life. What a strange little life.
Have you ever dreamed about releasing a new project or game that you haven't been doing yet? Like, I dreamed about making a game about something else or something like this.
Oh, yeah. All right. But that's a great question. So, yeah, I have something that I've barely scratched the surface on. It's very much like, have you played The Quiet Year, where you sit down and draw the map together? Similar to that, but more of a, and I know I hate saying it, but more of a LARP, like an IRL LARP that's mostly in your head. So this sort of goes back to like the real world stuff that I want to do, that I'm kind of longing for. So that I'm hoping to, like, once the Morkborg action figure is in production, I should have more time at the end of the year to develop that, God willing. But that is something I've been dreaming about, and I hope it's a very highly emotional game. Like, I'm going for like super high emotion, similar to 10 Candles too.
Nice. Wow, very cool. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say that would be dreamy, that's all.
If you could live in a fictional setting, you know, either from games or literature, movies, TV shows, whatever, like a fictional setting, world, universe, where would you live in, and who would you be in that universe?
Holy cow. That's hard, because like all the stuff I like is so bleak, like I wouldn't want to be there.
Well, I mean, it's fantasy. Like, you could want to be like a, I don't know, an adventurer in Morkborg and die horribly. I don't know. But you can choose place, a cool place to live, but it's hard, because like a lot of the stuff we really like, there's a lot of conflicts and dire peril, so everything it will be kind of scary, right?
Absolutely.
You can be like a completely oblivious hobbit on Middle Earth. That can work, I guess.
Well, so since I like the Hellboy BPRD universe so much, I can imagine being like a field agent with some sort of like not super powerful power, but like, you know, maybe I can like Johan from BPRD, he's the ghost inside the suit. So like he can float through things and he can embody objects and stuff like that. I can imagine being a low to mid-level field agent on assignment somewhere not very cold in that universe. That would be pretty awesome. Not too much responsibility, a pension at the end of 30 years. Sounds great.
Yeah.
Does a ghost person need a pension? I don't know. Do they even get one?
I don't know. Yeah. If you could have any superpower, what superpower would you choose to have? And what would be the first thing you would do with that?
Gosh, I mean, like, I always think about that episode of this, I think it's This American Life, where it's like flying versus teleportation, I think it was.
Yeah, those are the most popular ones, yeah.
I am going to go more sinister. I would be like the teleporting bank robber by night. You know, like, I'm 45 years old, I have a family, but no one knows that I can teleport. And I'm literally like raiding JP Morgan and, you know, kind of like a Robin Hood kind of deal. You know, not maybe enriching myself a little bit, but also doing good.
Yeah, yeah, that could work. That could be like a show, kind of, you know, Breaking Bad, like a middle-aged guy gets teleportation powers and starts, you know, yeah, I'm going to do Robin Hood, but start screwing it up. That could be a fun, weird show, too, yeah.
That's it. We're rich, baby. Let's write it. Yeah.
If you could choose any weird and fictitious thing from fantasy, sci-fi, or whatever, from books, comics, games, anything, and make that thing real in our world, in our reality, what would you choose and why? And that can be, you know, a faction, a location, an object, a weapon, energy source, anything like this.
Yeah. Well, I think about this quite a bit. Like, we live in like 2024, and all the science fiction from like the 50s and 60s is so optimistic. It's like, by the year 2020, we'll have flying cars and everyone, no one will have to work and all this stuff. And it's like,
we will appeal, we'll have all the food we need and stuff.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah. Every problem is solved. And like, well, we're just never going to get there because income inequality and the way the systems are set up, it's just like, it doesn't matter what great tech we have. Like, we're still mud people on the mud ball. And like, we can't even solve those problems. It just really, really stinks. So like, I would love to answer your question. I would love to like have like a ring world space station up in space where anyone can just go up to and get off the mud ball and just evolve. Just forget about languages and forget about physicality and just sort of
scarcity,
like,
yeah,
just fast forward our evolution off the mud ball, because we literally can't solve the mud ball problem and we're never gonna get anywhere because we're just like starving and trying to get our kids in the car without getting carjacked. Like, the shit, what the hell? It's just too hard. Yeah, I want a giant space station for all. Like, anyone can go up there anytime they want by some sort of conveyor belt elevator system and just be yourself. Yeah. You can go up there and role play.
That would be great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And finally, the last question would be, do you remember the last time you felt really happy and you know, grateful for being here and being alive? And if you do, can you share with us, when was it, and then what was it that you were doing and experiencing?
I mean, I hate to talk about kids again, but, you know.
That's great. That's the good stuff.
It is the good stuff, yeah. Well, you know, I'll share a little something. So COVID was obviously hard for everybody in a number of ways. So my wife was pregnant when COVID happened. We were like a month and a half, 2 months into it. COVID hit. We're all stressed out about that. And then we lost the baby. And she, it was early enough in the pregnancy where it wasn't like hugely emotional, but it was still pretty hard. And we had like no one to talk to. I mean, I didn't tell my parents. I think Mary probably told her parents, but we couldn't like go to friends' houses. It was just us at the house with Ivor, and it sucked. I mean, it was like really, it was harder than hard because we were already like terrified of COVID anyway. And, you know, it was like March, April of COVID. So we like kind of sucked that up and like just didn't really process that. And then we got pregnant again, had our son, our next son during COVID. And just that experience, like having that renewal, I guess, like even though it was still in the heart of the pandemic, like it's still, it was a really unreal feeling.
Yeah, you made a new friends during the COVID the pandemic.
Yeah, that's great. That was pretty great because you have one kid. It's usually like with every next kid, you're like, oh, here's another one. But it wasn't just another one, of course. But like, it was like, you know,
that's beautiful. And
came out of all
hard,
this stuff.
And I can't imagine what I have been through. But you know, kind of a cycle as you know, a new beginning.
Yeah,
and I think COVID was a reset for a lot of people, right? Too, you know, it's hard to talk about that. Yeah,
it is. This is a great podcast. I'll tell you, you ask amazing questions, and I feel like I revealed stuff to you that I have never revealed to anyone. Two things: the thing about my parents being actually helpful for once, and you know, the baby stuff. So,
well,
you got
thank
it out
you
of
so
me.
Much for the generosity and you know, courage to share this, and I'm really grateful. And I think it makes us closer as both me and you as a friend. I really consider as a friend. You're a great person, and I'm really grateful for you sharing this. But in being a podcast, we're kind of sharing with the community too. But as you said, like, the community is a great thing, and we're all really grateful for you for everything that you do, and maybe learning a little bit more about you make us feel a little bit closer, and you know, I don't know, grateful and more understanding of the stuff that you do too, because whether we want it or not, all those things infuse our work, even subconsciously, right? So, So, just saying, I'm really, really grateful for you for being here. Those were all the questions I had, and do you have any last message for the wonderful weirdos out there that are listening to us?
Yes. Despite being a mud person and living on this mud ball, I think that you're wonderful and don't ever stop creating stuff. If you like to draw, just keep drawing. If you like to write, keep writing. It has brought me endless joy and kept me out of the mud jail. And just keep doing it. Like, seriously, just never give up, because creativity it's freedom. It's like, we talk about freedom in America, which is BS. Creativity is the real freedom.
Yeah. And, you know, even being, you know, mud people in a mud ball, we can still make mud bricks, right? And we can build stuff, and we can, you know, make a little house for other weird mud balls hang out and play pretend for a while. So it's great. Justin, can you take us out saying the catchphrase of the show? Keep it weird, everybody.
Keep it weird, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Weird Games and Weirder People. If you'd like to keep up with the show, please subscribe to be notified when we release new episodes. If you'd like to support us, please leave a review or head on to ko-fi.com/WGNWP. See you next time, and remember, weird is the new wonderful.